Is Northeast Florida an age-friendly place? And if not, what can we do about it? That conversation is just ahead. Good Monday morning. Hope you had a great weekend. Right now, it's live from Studio 5 as we begin First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live on the radio, and now you can catch our daily podcast, too. It's on iTunes. Just ahead, how advocates for seniors are getting the First Coast to rethink aging, in particular, aging in place. We want your calls right now. Give us a call at 549-2937. Then later we'll tell you about a special screening of the new film Still Alice and a look at the effects of Alzheimer's disease on families. Plus, Culpepper on the controversy revving up at the Daytona 500. That's later in sports. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, it's a major new effort to make Northeast Florida more of an age-friendly place. Well, what does that mean? Here's how. JCCI, or the Jacksonville Community Council, Inc., is launching a new citizen-based inquiry, giving all of us a chance to influence decisions on everything from housing costs to transportation and more, all aspects of our local quality of life that affect mobility and independence for seniors. The idea is to rethink aging. With more, we welcome Ben Warner, CEO of JCCI. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
And Earl Evans, Executive Director of the AgeWell Institute at Baptist Health. Hi, Earl.
Good morning, Melissa.
It's so great to have you both on the show. And as we begin this discussion, let us know right now if you're listening. What do you think should be done to make the First Coast a friendlier place for people who are aging in place, for seniors? Give us a call. 549-2937, that's 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect, email and tweet the show. Ben, let's begin with you. You just began this inquiry, Rethink Aging. Why did JCCI decide to tackle this topic?
Well, as you know, when we look at issues that we need to talk about, we get input from the community and we look at the portions of our JAC's 2025 vision that need the most attention. And in this case, we saw that when we look at our demographics, Jacksonville and the entire Northeast Florida region is getting older, and we're not prepared for what that means. And there's a lot of opportunities we don't want to miss. This is part of us recognizing we're part of Florida and getting our arms around what it means to have a growing and older population.
Earl Evans, you're director of the AgeWell Institute at Baptist. Of course, we all want to age well. And as Ben pointed out, Jacksonville is the youngest major city in Florida. A lot of people here are 40 and younger, but we still have a pretty large population of seniors like other Florida cities, right?
That's certainly the case. And our aging community needs a lot of support in a lot of areas, and we're trying to be part of the answer to that challenge.
And what are some of the areas that you see, both of you? It's really standing out. When you say the support seniors need, what do they need the most?
Well, one of the things we know is that the backbone of how we deal with seniors is with the family. And so one of the biggest issues we're finding is that there's a caregiving community that finds itself often unduly stressed without the resources and supports that they need so that people can live independently at home with some help from family, or live with family with some help associated with that, and be able to still access all the services, go to the grocery store, things like that that they need. We haven't built our city around that. We haven't thought about what it means to have a city that allows people to age successfully and independently at home.
That's right. Jacksonville is a notoriously car-dependent city. Mm-hmm. We're big, we're spread out, you need a car in most places around town. That can be tough as someone gets older.
That's certainly the case. You know, we have a lot of good services in the region to support our seniors, but connecting the seniors to those services is quite a challenge given the transportation issues. And it's also a challenge for people to really understand what is available. There are a lot of providers in the community doing a lot of really good things, but getting that connected to families who are facing challenges is an important objective of the inquiry.
And isn't housing part of this too, Ben? The affordability of housing?
Well, it's the affordability and the availability, and it's the type of housing. So one of the things we're looking at is that many of the things that our senior population, especially those over 50, are looking for in terms of a livable community, a walkable community, are the same thing millennials are looking for. And so what we're looking at is as we think about aging differently, we're also thinking about community differently. We were told by our speaker last week, Sandy Markwood, who came down from Washington, D.C. She's the head of the National Area Agencies of Aging. And she said, when you're talking about these issues, I'm talking about the policies associated with it, these aren't aging issues or aging policies. These are community issues. And as we make the community more age-friendly, we're actually making it friendlier for all ages.
We'll go to your calls on the new Rethink Aging Initiative in just a moment at 549-2937. And Earl, you have some interesting background to share in terms of how other cities have dealt with these issues and what Jacksonville can learn, right?
Well, you know, there's a lot of work that's going on around the country, and we can learn from others as we tackle these challenges. One of the areas that had the opportunity to be involved in a little bit has to do with how to connect people in affordable housing to healthcare services in a way that really works. We know when we're trying to provide excellent geriatric care that issues of housing, transportation, social challenges must be dealt with if they're going to be able to follow through on an excellent healthcare regimen. And so there are some very interesting models now for organizations that are partnering with housing sites, with healthcare providers to bring services right to the site, along with coordination of service, which ultimately is often missing in the current system.
This is so timely, too, isn't it, Ben? Because more older Americans are making the decision that they don't want to go to an assisted living facility. Their people are living longer and they're healthier as they're living longer. More people want to, as you put it, age in place and stay in their home or be independent, not have an assisted living set up. And so as that population grows in this area, how critical is this inquiry, do you think?
Well, the AARP, who's one of our partners in this issue, just released a survey this morning. They surveyed 1,200 people over 45 here in Duval County. And they found the number one issue that people said is 95% said that as they grow older, they want to live independently. They want to be self-sufficient. They want to be able to deal with any emergencies. They want to afford the basics without worry. They want to be able to pay for long-term care needs. That's what people want. And so as we look at the way that we're thinking about aging differently, we need to say, how are we going to help people get what they want? Because being able to live independently and be able to age in place is not only usually the best solution for an individual, but it's also the least expensive for a community.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, as we discuss JCCI's new initiative, Rethink Aging. We want to hear from seniors out there, but we really want to hear from everyone as well. What do you think needs to be done to make the First Coast a better place for aging residents to live? 549-2937. Tom on the South Side is with us. Hey, Tom, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm in South Florida and in North Florida, I've worked in a lot of these ALFs and SNFs and stuff like that. And this is already the second largest nursing home state in the country. We've already got all of this stuff in place. Between all of the governing bodies in Tallahassee who are supposed to take a look at these assisted living facilities, I mean, we've already got all this stuff here. We just don't have, what am I trying to say? We don't have the rules and regulations behind it and the governing authority behind it to keep these facilities up to snuff. So, you know, we've already got it, and that's all I want to say, because I've worked in these places. I've seen the way they run, and they're only inspected every 3 to 5 years by the state, and it should be more. And it's heartbreaking to watch it, and that's why I'm not in it anymore. It's just, it's too much to watch. So
yeah. Yeah.
That's my two cents.
Okay, thank you. That's Tom on the South Side. Earl Evans, what about that? And in particular, when you look at, I mean, we think of South Florida as a magnet for seniors. What about Florida's status?
Well, I'm new to Jacksonville. I've only been here a few months, so I'm learning about the provider community. But what I have seen is, like in many regions, there are many high-quality providers in this community, places where people can not only feel safe in going, but they're going to get a high-quality experience. There are challenges with providers everywhere in the country, and the caller is expressing a concern that I think many have about the quality of regulation and oversight. And I think that's something that, you know, certainly can be enhanced. But I would say to the listeners, there are very good providers here that you can choose from.
549-2937. Let us know your thoughts on rethinking aging on the First Coast. John on the South Side is with us. Hey, John. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. You know, my first thought is when you're trying to connect, you know, the millennials and, you know, it's an aging senior population, and people are really just relocating from all, from everywhere, you know, just also just to get out of the cold and just for a better quality of life. I just think of this new downtown area, and I'd like to just hear, you know, the thoughts with, you know, this JEA development for Healthy Town, and then you just look where Baptist is in conjunction with that. And, you know, on a lighter note, you know, you look at the millennials and then the aging population and what's being created, you know, again in this area and across from this entertainment zone, you know, that we're promoting. And, you know, all the different exciting things that are being brought to downtown. And you can just picture, you know, with the millennials saying, you know, hey, Grandma, Grandpa, you know, we're getting in the wheelchair and doing the ale trail on the South Bank. And yeah, and we can just drop you off for your doctor's visit, too. So anyway, I just wondered, you know, what type of visioning that they do see, you know, in trying to, you know, put this all together.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, John. John on the South Side. Ben Warner.
Well, I'll tell you that certainly thinking about aging will affect the way that we think about downtown development.
Yeah,
and we're already,
sure.
It's already happening. In fact, some of our longest living downtown residents have been in the Cathedral Towers and places like that. But we need to think about aging differently because, for one thing, there's not a set population of aging. All of us are aging, and it sure beats the alternative. But when we think about different cutoff ages, are aging the ones over 65, over 45, over 55, what we're really thinking about is we have this continuum of people in our community who have different needs. And certainly there's going to be a driver in downtown development from people who are who may be retired, who may be in second careers, but who are no longer interested in having a big backyard and don't have small children at home. And we're going to see a lot more of that, and that's going to drive a lot of the economic development. Mm-hmm. Our aging population, that is those over 65, will grow by 80% over the next 25 years.
In our area alone.
In our area alone, far outpacing the population growth of any other population. And so if we're going to prepare for the future, we need to prepare for a future that is friendly to all ages.
Calls from across the listening area. Deborah in Palm Coast. Hey, Deborah. Good morning. Thanks for holding. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning, Melissa. I work at an assisted living facility in Holly Hill, and I love to work there. I love working with the independent, assisted, and memory care residents. I think my favorites are the memory care residents. And I'm a brain fitness instructor, so I work with them as best I can, dealing with all kinds of mental, cognitive stimulation. And I am very frustrated. I've worked there for a little over a year now. And what they have now is typical for a model based on the medical model there, where safety and health are, of course, the primary concerns. But I just got finished reading Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, and some other texts. And what I think is that we need this new model where we're looking more at their quality of health, quality of life, rather. Now, I agree with Tom to a degree, the Southside caller, that these assisted living facilities are doing great. They're providing quality within the model that they're using, but the model is limited. Mm. We need to take care of these residents, especially memory care, who are bored, lonely, and feeling helpless. We need so many more people working with them. We need a new model.
That's Deborah.
I love the work, and I'm doing as much as I can in the area, and I'm really doing what I can also to change the face of what we do, changing the model and getting the education out there.
Yeah, Deborah, that's Deborah in Palm Coast. Thank you so much for that good feedback. And guys, I'm sure you want citizens like Deborah to be part of this citizen inquiry, people that know something about this and are interested in it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we meet every Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock at the WJCT building, and it's open to everyone. And you can find out more about it at jcci.org. And what's interesting is we've also put, along with the handouts and the expert testimony we're getting from resource speakers, we also have a suggested reading list. And last week, Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, was one of the suggested readings because we have to think about the whole thing differently, not just are parents safe in where they're being kept, but are we really integrating people into the community in all of the ways that we can think about, so people can lead full, fulfilling lives all the way through.
What about her comment that we need to rethink the whole model for how we care for seniors?
Well, I think the caller's absolutely right about that. Historically, our nursing homes were designed from a medical model, and they, you know, the regulation framework is built around the medical model. And unfortunately, that has not met the needs of our people who are living long-term in these facilities. It's important to distinguish between those that are coming into nursing homes for a short stay, a rehabilitative period of time. They're not going to be living there. They're going to return then to their own homes versus those that will be their home. And those individuals need a model that is much broader than simple medical care. And that's what you see in our high-quality providers in the community. They are reorganizing and restructuring their services to enhance the entire continuum of quality of life. I would remark in terms of the caller that they are there are some challenges with the regulatory framework, which makes it hard to do some of the things that people like your caller see are needed.
Mabel tweets the show, until you have a senior needing help, you don't really understand what it involves in time, money, and compassion. She goes on to say, we need more quality assisted and independent living facilities in our area. Jacksonville is 10 to 15 years or more behind South Florida for seniors. And then, as you mentioned, Ben, AARP Florida out with a new survey. They just sent me the news release finding that Jacksonville voters overwhelmingly support keeping older and disabled loved ones in their homes. Yet AARP Jacksonville says voters need to put their voice to the state capitol and ask that lawmakers look at the state budget to rejigger, I guess, the way that we look at this issue. Can you talk about the public policy piece?
Well, certainly. We know right now, for example, that over half of all Jacksonville residents 45 and older, over half either are currently or in the very near future will be caregivers for an older family member. And we also know that for most of them, they may be currently working, and that those who are caring for someone often have to take unpaid leave from work, have financial hardships, have incredible amounts of stress. The caregiving and support for not only the older adult but for the caregiver are things that we really need to look at. And I want to applaud Community Hospice of Northeast Florida for leading the charge to look at how we support caregivers, because there's a lot of people who really want to help but have a tough time getting the support they needed to help those who need.
Warner on the South Side. Hey, Warner, what are your thoughts? Good morning, Warner.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I'm calling for something a little different, but I hope it can get some reflection from some of you. I am concerned about the fact that I've had a difficult time finding a facility for the moderate income person. I have been told that my retirement is too much for the ones on the HUD, and I don't have enough money for the upper level. So as a middle-class person, here I suffer again.
Sure, and I'm sure many are in your same predicament, Warner. Thanks.
And yeah. I'm 76 years old, we're retired, and I would like for some, and I don't need a big house to live in any longer.
Right, so what do you do?
I would like a community or a facility that provides at a moderate price from a moderate income.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Thanks, Warner. And there are so many like her, and they can't find what they need, not always, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the advantages, I think, to being 10 to 15 years behind South Florida, is we can look at what's working in many different communities and to implement those here. And one of the things we're looking at are those opportunities. For example, right now, you can't create sort of a mother-in-law suite or a garage apartment or something like that at your home to be able to provide that sort of step down, still independent, but with somebody living right there, being able to watch over and check up on you. You can't do that because of zoning codes in most places. And so is there a public policy issue there? As we're looking at different kinds of housing setup, there are needs for all income levels, and we need to pay attention to that.
Pamela in St. Augustine. Hey, Pamela, what are your thoughts? Good morning.
Good morning. I'm visiting from Canada, and one of the biggest shocks that I encounter is that as a senior, I'm here for quite a while, you cannot survive here without a car, and I don't drive. And I think that the lack of bus service is quite astonishing. I'm not saying things are so great where I live in Canada, but we have phenomenal public bus service. And that would be one of the biggest comments I would have as a senior. I'm a senior myself. And the lack of any decent bus services is pretty surprising. So that's really my comment around getting around town and lack of good public transport.
Sure.
So I'll leave it at that.
Yes. Thank you, Pamela. And that is a big concern for seniors, for a lot of people, but especially, Earl, for seniors.
Yeah, I think the caller's observation is an important one. We have a very dispersed community, heavily dependent on transportation via cars and buses, and we have to find a way to provide an affordable public transit solution or paratransit solution to get people connected, not just to healthcare needs, but to all the aspects of our wonderful community here.
So you've got your work cut out for you, certainly, but this initiative is underway, Ben. Let's let people know again how they can be a part of Rethink Aging.
You can go to on the website at www.jcci.org, jcci.org, and it has all of the details there. If you're not happy with the internet, you can always just show up Tuesday mornings at 9 o'clock at the WJCT studios across the street from the stadium, and come join us and be part of the conversation. We need to hear from as many people from the community as we can if we're going to change the way we think about aging.
That's right. This is open to everyone. JCCI's Rethink Aging Initiative, every Tuesday at 9 here in our building, or just go on the web to find out more at jcci.org. CEO Ben Warner and Earl Evans of the AgeWell Institute, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead later. Controversy at the Daytona 500, and the race hasn't even happened yet. Cole Pepper will tell us all about it. But up next, a closer look at the Oscar-nominated film Still Alice, showing the harrowing effects of Alzheimer's. That's next.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Fuja,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Cher Krause Knight is both an unapologetic fan of Disney World and an academic. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Cher Krause Knight about her book Power and Paradise in Walt Disney's World. We'll discuss early land grants in Florida and talk about Jackson County in the Reconstruction era. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, actress Julianne Moore is the odds-on favorite to win the Best Actress Oscar this month for her gripping portrayal of a woman dealing with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. Moore plays a respected professor in the new film Still Alice. In the story, she's only 50 and in the prime of life, but gradually we witness her descent into confusion. Here's a scene between Moore and Kristen Stewart, who plays her daughter.
What's it like? Like, what does it actually feel like?
Well, it's not always the same. You know, I have good days, bad days, and on my good days, I can, you know, almost pass for a normal person. But on my bad days, I feel like I can't find myself. I've always been so defined by my intellect, my language, my articulation, and now sometimes I can see the words hanging in front of me and I can't reach them and I don't know who I am and I don't know what I'm gonna lose next.
Sounds horrible.
Thanks for asking.
So for Alice, at first it's simple things like forgetting a word or someone's name. We've all done that. Then it evolves into more troubling episodes like going for a run and becoming completely lost and disoriented. Alice is scared, and the viewer is scared for her. Once she's officially diagnosed, the disease becomes a horrible ordeal for her entire family. And this powerful portrayal of the effects of Alzheimer's on patients and their caregivers has become a teaching opportunity for advocates and researchers into the disease. There's going to be a special screening of Still Alice this week at the San Marco Theater. With a preview now, we welcome Michelle Branham, Director of Communications and Public Policy with the local chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Michelle, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So good to see you. And as awful as this disease is, it's great news that it looks as though Julianne Moore is probably going to win the Oscar for this portrayal. That's going to help bring a lot of awareness about Alzheimer's disease, isn't it?
I think it's important. This film is very important to the community awareness for the disease. And when you bring it out into the limelight, Julianne's performance has been so amazing. She won the Golden Globe. She won an award at SAG and then up for the Oscar. And I think that just brings it into the American dialogue in a very real and opportune way.
And she, in the film, she has early onset Alzheimer's. She's pretty young. And we think of this as a disease only affecting much older folks. But that's not always the case.
It isn't always the case. And I think that's important to put a different face on Alzheimer's. We think it's a senior's disease. But Julianne does such a good job of portraying it. Lots of people that we work with here at the local chapter and all over the country have early onset. So they're getting Alzheimer's disease in their 40s and in their 50s and even in their 60s.
It's so devastating for the person who has the disease and, as that film shows, for the loved ones around the person. How do the local advocates at the Alzheimer's Association try to work with families?
I think it's very difficult. Alzheimer's disease, the caregiving process is so tremendously difficult, and it can be so very long. Alzheimer's can be, you can have it for 10, 12, even 18 years. Some of our constituents have it for that amount of time. And I think it's a full-time caregiving experience. So I think what I like about our organization is as we work for research, as we work for treatment, as we work for preventative measures, we're also working with the folks that currently have it. And how do we find the best ways to help them and their families take this journey on, because it's so difficult.
Now, since the film was released, and by the way, it was based on a best-selling book, since the book and the movie were released, new research was actually published. Can you tell us about it?
Well, that's what's exciting about the screening, and it's a private screening. We are having Dr. Graf Radford from Mayo Clinic and Dr. Rosa Rademacher come before the film and talk. Since the book came out 10 years ago, and even since the movie was filmed, new science and research has come about. So it's exciting to see the momentum increasing and for that movie to showcase awareness and then to see the new research that is happening. And that's what Dr. Graf Radford and Dr. Rosa Rademacher will talk about before we show the film.
What have they found?
I think Dr. Graf Radford is working on some very exciting research. Perhaps we will change the trajectory of the disease. If you have been reading a little bit about it, there is new science about a retina scan where you can detect the amyloid plaque in the eye. Now, what happens if you could detect it at our age so that we could change the trajectory of our symptoms so that we don't get the dementia symptoms in our 60s and 70s? What happens if there was some preventative opportunity prior to?
Sure.
So I think they're looking at every case scenario, whether we treat the dementia as it's happening or treat the dementia before it happens.
And of course, we all want to try those preventative measures. I've heard everything from do crossword puzzles every day to keep your cognitive skills sharp to another folk tale is avoid copper pots. don't use copper-bottomed pots. For a while there, it was thought there was a link between copper and Alzheimer's. There's a lot out there, a lot of information, but can you give us the official lines when it comes to the best way to stay healthy and try to ward this disease off?
Well, this is where I get really excited that we have some of the best researchers in the country in our own backyard,
right
here at Mayo Clinic.
Right.
So when I listen to Dr. Graf Radford speak, I get relentlessly optimistic. I get excited because I think the research is there, and I think wonderful people like him are really on the cutting edge. What Dr. Graf Radford mentioned in a seminar I went to is exercise. So he was talking about exercise 30 minutes a day for 3 days a week, having a fairly healthy diet, and we recommend a Mediterranean diet. You've heard that. But I think exercise, Mediterranean diet, keeping social, and also, like you said, doing some things that are problem solving, like a crossword puzzle, but keeping your mind active. But I think what we would suggest too is know your numbers, know your cholesterol numbers, know your blood pressure numbers. Be your own best health advocate. And mm-hmm. I think with those things in mind, it's your best option for preventative.
Sure. And as you said, this screening Wednesday is private. And what's fascinating, too, to hear is that the Alzheimer's Association team actually worked with Julianne Moore to give her some feedback and background on how to portray this character.
What was exciting is we just came back from our leadership conference in Orlando. There is a wonderful, beautiful woman with red hair who looks a lot like Julianne Moore, and she turned 50 with Julianne Moore. So Julianne Moore shadowed her, and she is on our National Advisory Board for Early Onset Alzheimer's. So there are people out there using what they have, using the knowledge, getting on the very inside of the disease and speaking to that as long as they possibly can. So the courage behind this beautiful woman who spent time with Julianne Moore is amazing, and she works with us.
That's fantastic. And thanks so much for sharing awareness with us this week. The screening of Still Alice at the San Marco Theater, as you said, it's private, but the film is in theaters now. So anyone interested should go see it. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Michelle Branham, Director of Communications and Public Policy with the local chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. And we're back in a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. government is expected to make new recommendations on cholesterol, reversing decades-long advice to limit food like eggs. What's behind the proposed guidelines and how consumers can make healthy choices. Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica, only on 89.9 FM After Hours.
WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT TV and radio. Submit now through March 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
Welcome back. Well, next week, our First Coast Connect book club is going to tackle a new discussion, and we really want your responses for the next book we're featuring on the show. Our book club blogger, Stacey Goldring, will discuss The Sense of an Ending by author Julian Barnes. It's about a retired man who recalls his school clique when he was a boy, and he reflects on the paths he and his friends have taken. The story deals with themes of memory and time. So here's our question. We want to know, why do you think we edit our memories over time? Is our memory unreliable? What are your memories of school and your friends? We want your comments. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Be part of our book club. Next week, we're going to read your comments on the air as we discuss The Sense of an Ending. While it's an exciting opportunity for local artists, nominations are now open for the Cultural Council's 39th Annual Arts Awards, a celebrated Jacksonville tradition. Winners will be honored at the Big Awards Gala coming up in May in the heart of the city's urban core and in a very unusual place. Daniel Austin, Communications Manager for the Cultural Council, has a preview this morning. Hey, Daniel.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So this deadline is coming up fast for nominations.
It sure is. It's this Thursday. So thanks so much for having us on the show today.
Sure.
Wanted to talk to everybody and say, we need some more nominations in. Tell us who is supporting arts and culture in Jacksonville. The Arts Awards is really about celebrating the people that support the arts and culture community. It's not necessarily only for the artists. So we want to see who's making those differences in the community, who's making these things happen.
And there are certain categories.
That's correct. So we have open categories for nominations. You can find all this information at culturalcouncil.org/artsawards. But we're looking for the Robert Arley White Art Advocacy Award, of course, named for our former executive director, Bob White.
Very nice.
We got our Art Educator Award, the Art Innovator, Art Philanthropist, and Emerging Artist. So we're looking for an emerging artist, someone that's had a breakout year, someone that's made an impact on the community. Innovators, we're looking for people that are breaking new ground, making things happen. And Educator and Philanthropist, obviously, we're looking for people there that support the arts and that teach the arts to our next generations.
And it's important to honor the people really leading the way. They'll all be honored at a big awards gala, Light the Night, coming up in May.
That's correct. It'll be May 2nd, that first beautiful weekend in May. And we're going to have a wonderful celebration right in the heart of the Spark District. We're going to do it on the rooftop of the Duval Street parking garage.
How cool is that? and so that's a completely different way of doing this.
Yeah, very different. So last year was very different as well. We did Night of Fire in the Marble Bank building, as you might remember. This year, we're going to do Light the Night outside. We're going to do some really beautiful things with light and make you see the city in a different way, hopefully.
Yeah.
And it'll be a beautiful event that we really want to celebrate these people. We're going to have more tickets available than we did for last year's event. We have a bigger capacity. So you can also get tickets at that same website, culturalcouncil.org/artsawards.
Very nice. Anything else people need to know? As you said, the deadline is Thursday. So if you're just hearing about this, you've only got a few more days to think of someone you think is deserving of this prestigious award and get your nomination in.
That's right. And we've had some really strong nominations come in, but we want to reach even deeper into the community. Nominations are very simple. We're just looking for a short essay of 500 words or less. And all you need to do is talk about their impact on the community, how they've made a difference. And you can email those to me, daniel@culturalcouncil.org. But again, you can find those full specific nomination qualifications online.
Yeah, go to culturalcouncil.org/artsawards. It's the 39th Annual Arts Awards. Nominate your favorites right now and help us support arts and culture on the First Coast. Daniel Austin, Communications Manager for the Cultural Council here today. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
And finally, this hour, controversy at Daytona and the big race isn't even for another week.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
With more now on the 500 and the rest of this week's sports, here's our own Cole Pepper. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. As you know, the Daytona 500 is steeped in tradition.
Yes.
And sometimes tradition is also about routine. And for the first time at the Daytona 500, they changed the way drivers qualify for the Great American Race. In essence, they've made it so a driver doesn't just run around the track on his own. It led to some controversy, especially because teammates Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson seem to figure out how to game the system. And after all, NASCAR is nothing if not a race to figure out how to best game the system.
What did they do?
Well, they basically tandemed it together and were able to push each other on track. And in the past, it's just been go out there, run on your own, and one car on the track at a time, and see who runs the fastest, who has the fastest car, and that'll be the guy who'll be up front. Well, now you introduce this opportunity to do some drafting and pushing and so forth. And, I mean, it's not rocket science here, but Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson, who are two of the best drivers ever, and remember, this is probably going to be, as long as what he says is true, Jeff Gordon's last Daytona 500.
Right.
So he'll start on the pole with Jimmy Johnson second, his teammate right there. So it could be quite a thing to watch come Sunday.
This is like the deflated football thing, isn't it?
Well,
in a way.
You know, this, if you think about it, they didn't break any rules.
Okay.
They just figured out how this new system works better, either
better
sooner or better
else.
Than anybody else did. And it kind of surprises me, quite frankly, because, again, NASCAR, you have the whole team, the pit crew, your technical team, the whole bit, and there are always guys who are good at figuring out how far can we push this to the point where, you know, to the edge of the rule and maybe even a little bit past. In fact, there are a couple of guys who had their cars red flagged in post-race inspections because they had gone too far, so they'll have to race from the back of the pack. But, you know, this is going to be, you know, a story this week, and then as soon as they start the race, as soon as they drop the green flag on Sunday, it'll all be forgotten. It'll all be about the race.
Interesting. But Jeff Gordon's last year, that's sort of the end of an era.
Yeah, he says he's going to go into sort of retirement.
They always say that, and then they don't.
Well, some, yeah.
How many athletes have said, I'm retiring?
Well, you know, and in NASCAR, if you're healthy, you know, and still winning, and Jeff Gordon is, obviously, he's still a competitive driver, has a great team. There's going to be some sponsor pressure to keep racing here and there, and I think he will a bit, but he's not going to run the full-time thing. And we think of Jeff Gordon, you know, as a younger guy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he's been doing it for, he started so young, and he's been doing it for so long, and, you know, quite frankly, every time those guys get behind the wheel, they are, you know, they're taunting death and injury because when you go 200 miles an hour plus around with, you know, a couple of dozen of your nearest friends who might want to bump or rub you off the track, then Anytime you walk away from a race on your own two feet, it's a pretty good race.
Sure. So as people follow NASCAR at the same time, the Jaguars about to release their State of the Franchise report, and there's a lot coming out with this.
Yeah, it'll be tomorrow at 11 o'clock, and among the things we expect to hear in the announcement, some more substantial discussion about how Shad Khan plans to develop the shipyards, and indoor practice facilities expected to be included in that. And of course, they'll be talking about, from a business standpoint, their season ticket base, where they are within the league, some of their strategic goals that they have to try to raise the amount of local revenue so they can spend in free agency. Now, this all being said, they have a huge amount of free agency money potentially to be spent from as far as the salary cap is concerned, and we expect that this will be a very spendy free agent period once that rolls around in March.
Okay, let's talk March Madness. It's 2 weeks away, less than 2 weeks away.
Well, yeah, and so we'll get into March anyway. The madness doesn't start March 1st for everybody, but for some of the teams, it's getting maddening right now. The Gators really struggling right now. Lost by a point to Texas A&M on Saturday. They fall below 500 overall. They're just 5-7 in the SEC, looking more and more like the Gators will be left out of the big dance in March. You know, you might recall, I made my prediction that Florida, despite a rough start, we did our first of the year predictions. I thought Billy Donovan would get it turned around.
Yeah, you did.
They'd be competitive. They wind up with 19-20 wins, and they get in the tournament. Now it doesn't look like they're going to make the tournament. And it's been
a
really disappointing season. And if it was anybody other than Billy Donovan who has led the Gators to two national championships, might be some very serious questions being asked about the direction of the Florida program, even though this is sort of, I think this is just a one-off. I think he'll get it figured out. He does need to get some better players. Some of the guys who were big-time recruits who he was brought in have not developed and have not delivered.
Is it hard for that basketball program to get the attention it deserves since football tends to crowd everything else out on that campus?
You know, it's a great question because there is this theory that you either have to be a football school or a basketball school. After all, nobody tends to fear my alma mater, Kansas, or Duke, or North Carolina, or Indiana, or Kentucky in football.
Right,
now, there
right.
have been some years where those schools have had, you know, pretty decent teams, but nobody is afraid that that's going to be an ongoing long-term thing. Same thing is, you know, you can put your resources toward wherever you need to. And, of course, Florida is one of the wealthier athletic departments, due in no small part to Gatorade royalties. But if you look at the schools who have been able to, for a long time, sustain excellent, if not elite, football and basketball programs, usually it's because you get a great coach in your off sport and it happens to sustain for a while and then falls off and then you come back. And I think of a school like Michigan that's been such a great football program traditionally. Well, their football program's been down a bit, but they're, you know, they've had some great runs in basketball. Arizona's been able to do that, although you wouldn't call them necessarily an elite football program. It's tough to have both do very well. Texas, who has so much, you know, a lot of oil money, obviously, in Texas. Nike money out in Oregon has tried to do that. But they just, it's very difficult to be great at both at the same time for any length of time.
Absolutely. But the bright note is our local universities are really doing great with their programs, well, UNF and JU.
UNF, as far as the season, JU in sort of a snapshot, UNF firmly in second place in the A-Sun after JU helped out the Ospreys with a decisive road win over USC Upstate, the third-place team of the Atlantic Sun. It was just JU's second conference victory, but it was a big one, and it sets up a potential de facto regular season championship game next week. If both UNF and first-place Florida Gulf Coast continue to win, they could meet to determine the regular season title. Now, remember, though, it is the conference tournament champion that gets the automatic bid to the big dance, so it's what happens in the conference tournament that's really important, but seeding can certainly come into play here. And it will be interesting to see, even if, you know, if JU winds up playing one of those two schools early on in the round, they could play the role of spoiler and start determining who could potentially wind up representing the Atlantic Sun in the NCAA basketball tournament.
Interesting. And the athletics at JU, there's been a real focus on that. I saw people posting on Facebook and Twitter yesterday, a big crowd for their lacrosse match.
Yeah, I was
lots
out there.
Of people. You were there.
Yeah, I was there. I was doing the public address announcing the Mo's Lacrosse Classic. They used to play this at Everbank Field, and they've moved it onto campus. They have the Dolphins taking on Army yesterday, one of the top 20 teams in the country. Army with a big win, but over 3,500 fans in the stands, basically packed out the entire grandstand there to watch that. And today, JU will be the site as high school lacrosse teams play. They've already started this morning. In fact, at 8 a.m. this morning, they've been going for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. They'll be playing all the way throughout the course of the day. And it's really a showcase for the emerging sport of lacrosse.
That is so great to see. And then last but not least, of course, you're one of the voices of the Jacksonville Armada, and they are off to a strong start as well.
Well, after that preseason victory over the Philadelphia Union at Everbank Field before a North American Soccer League preseason record crowd, they'll go on the road Wednesday to play Charleston. That's a USL squad. That's the league right below the North American Soccer League. The Armada will be back home for their next preseason match in Jacksonville February 28th at Community First Park at the baseball grounds of Jacksonville. Remember, you go from 14,000, Community First Park is going to hold about 8,500. So this is certainly going to be a hot ticket
That's
for the return.
That's going to be great. I hope they pack those stands, and it'll be and you'll be there as well, calling it for television. Very exciting.
Yep. It's been a great start to things for the Armada.
Cole Pepper, always with great sports news. Thanks, as always, for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got feedback for us, we want to hear it. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast. It's now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, the U.S. government is expected to make new recommendations on cholesterol, reversing decades-long advice to limit foods like eggs. What's behind the proposed guidelines and how consumers can make healthy choices? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. Make sure to tune in at 9 a.m. tomorrow. We'll discuss the ongoing controversy over Common Core state standards for education, and Facts of Life star Lisa Welschel will be in studio. That's all tomorrow. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.